This is an ABC podcast.
Bulla, this is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, hundreds more people test positive for COVID-19 in Solomon Islands as residents prepare for another lockdown. But testing pressures mean health authorities fear there could be hundreds more undetected cases in the community.
We are not testing the people who have mild symptoms and belong to the general population right now.
We'll hear more from Solomon Islands health advisor, Dr. Yogesh Chowdhury, soon. And we'll also go to Tonga, where businesses face the daunting task of cleaning up after the tsunami. Here's how one resort owner describes what's left of her once pristine oasis.
It's like a bomb hit this place, you know? It's like a war zone.
And we'll also hear what's making headlines around the region and listen to some great tunes along the way. I'm your host, Priyanka Srinivasan. Great to have your company. Health authorities are alarmed at the spread of COVID-19 in the Pacific. Samoa has extended its lockdown for another 72 hours after more positive COVID-19 cases came to light. Samoa's Prime Minister, Fiame Naiome Mataafa, addressed the nation in a press conference.
5 more new cases have been identified in quarantine, taking the number of positive cases to 20. These 5 cases are frontline workers who are monitoring the 15 individuals who have tested positive since Saturday last week. All 20 cases are asymptomatic and all are being quarantined at special isolation units at Mototua.
Samoa's lockdown is set to last until 6 p.m. on Thursday, but shops, supermarkets and pharmacies will be allowed to stay open for people to get supplies. Over in the Solomon Islands, the capital, Honiara, will also enter another COVID-19 lockdown. It will start from this evening and last for 4 days. 156 new cases were recorded yesterday, but authorities fear there could be many more infections circulating undetected in the community. And further north in the Pacific, Kiribati declared a state of disaster yesterday because of its rising COVID cases. Palau is also battling a COVID outbreak. Dubrovka Voloda took a closer look at the spread of the virus in the region.
With a lockdown looming, Honiara residents queued for hours on Monday to get their COVID vaccination and withdraw money from banks to buy supplies. Prime Minister Manase Sugavare says it will be a 4-day lockdown.
I therefore declared that from 6 p.m. Tuesday, 25th of January, 2022 until 6 p.m. Saturday, 29th January, the Honiara Emergency Zone will be in lockdown.
A senior advisor to the Health Ministry, Dr. Yogesh Chowdhury, says hundreds of people have now tested positive for the virus, but the number is likely to be much higher.
We can only do 200 tests in a day, and there's a lot of backlog of samples that need to be tested also. So we have focused our testing on priority groups, including people who have very serious disease or people who are working in a critical infrastructure. We are not testing the people who have mild symptoms and belong to the general population right now.
He says if people experience mild symptoms, they should stay at home to try to get better, since the hospital is at full capacity with more severe cases. Australia has lifted medical supplies to the country to help with the outbreak, including oxygen tanks, PPE gear, medical equipment and sanitation kits. Dr. Chowdhury says 47% of the population have received one dose of a COVID vaccine and they plan to open mobile vaccination clinics for easier access. He says people should mask up and stay at home to help contain the outbreak.
Don't panic and don't rush for testing.
The ministry is waiting for genomic sequencing results to come back from Australia to find out the variant they're dealing with. Adding to the country's woes, Mr. Sugavare says some public servants have refused to come to work.
More than 150 public servants from other government ministries were trained to assist the Ministry of Health to do contact tracing and do recording, answering of phone hotlines during community outbreaks. I further understand many of these public servants are refusing to come to assist when contacted by the Ministry of Health to assist.
Samoa kept COVID at bay for the past 2 years, but it went into a 48-hour lockdown on Saturday night over fears of community transmission. Its Ministry of Health says all frontline workers were taken into quarantine and have tested negative so far, while 15 airline passengers who tested positive are being monitored in isolation. A professor of international health at Curtin University, Jaya Dantas, says lockdowns will be beneficial for many island nations to help them stop the spread.
The snap lockdown is a good choice for these countries because the population is extremely small and it can be quite vulnerable.
Another country in lockdown since last weekend is Kiribati, whose president on Monday declared a state of disaster. There are now a few dozen confirmed cases and a 24-hour curfew is in place in South Tarawa and the community of Pota. And Palau has reported its first COVID cases in the community this month after a number of travelers tested positive. According to the Ministry of Health, there are 345 active cases as of Saturday. Professor Danta says people should be vigilant and watch out for each other to contain the virus.
Masking in indoor spaces or at large events, trying to avoid large events, you know, and in indoor spaces, trying to see that there's enough ventilation. These are the measures that people can do on their own.
Since Palau has a high vaccination rate, it's not expected to go into lockdown.
That was Dubrovka Volodare reporting there. And let's take a closer look at that outbreak in Kiribati. For most of the pandemic, it has been one of the few countries in the world that has remained COVID-free. But that all changed about 10 days ago when Kiribati reopened its international borders for the first time in months, only to have dozens of passengers on a flight from Fiji test positive. It's now in the midst of an escalating outbreak with several dozen community cases reported. A security guard at the quarantine facility is believed to have interacted with passengers on the flight, which led to the community infections. A 24-hour curfew lockdown has been imposed, as we heard, on South Tarawa and the community of Pota. Journalist Ramon Ramon is in Kiribati and joins us now on the line from Tarawa. Maori, good morning, Ramon.
Good morning, Priyanka. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Now, can you tell us more about the scale of this outbreak in Kiribati? How many people have been infected now?
Well, as you mentioned earlier from that security guard, it's been a one community transmission case into something that is now about 30 community transmission cases. So in total at the moment, there's 66. That's the recorded cases with seven just announced last night.
And is there, I mean, we heard in Solomon Islands that there were some pressures on testing and that not everyone can get tested. How is it going in Kiribati? Is there enough, are people coming forward to get tested? And are we confident in those numbers of infections?
Well, the first dose has, you know, is more than 90%. The second dose is just over 50%. So a lot of people are kind of mixed, have mixed feelings about the vaccinations. But I think there's been quite a rush, especially a scare in people that the virus is here unexpectedly, or they were didn't expect to arrive. There's been a drive by people personally motivated to go and get vaccinated, given that that's the only cover that they can have against the virus.
Mm. And you mentioned there's a high rate of first dose vaccination. I understand the second dose vaccination sits somewhere around 53% at the moment. With that, has anyone fallen sick yet? Has anyone gotten ill from COVID yet in Kiribati?
Well, a lot has. I think that has been the case, and as is the case for the coronavirus. The Ministry of Health has issued a service to go and test people under the houses, and since the outbreak, the community transmission outbreak, they haven't really been able to do that, and they've requested people saying that now they can't do that. Because they're catering only for people that have serious cases, such as breathing problems and that. So I think that it's escalating as the days come by. That's kind of situation at the moment in Kiribati.
And with that escalation, what's the public reaction been, particularly to the lockdowns? Are most people supportive of those measures?
Kiribati is quite a close-knit community kind of people, you know, if you know what I mean. They love to interact and you know, it's government is finding it hard to try and enforce that. A lot of people are taking it seriously, especially those with kids and parents, looking after the safety of that. So they are quite happy to take measures, even actually going beyond ahead of government to taking protecting themselves before government actually calls for a curfew or a lockdown. But then there are others who think they are vaccinated, who think that it's just a normal kind of flu, and I think it's quite frustrating when everyone's trying to protect themselves, and then there's that percentage of the population who think it's just a joke.
Yes, that is a shame. But though, as someone from Melbourne, I do understand the challenges of lockdown that you explained there, especially for families with young children. But how are those under the strictest lockdowns and the quarantine faring? I understand in Pota, for instance, the lockdown was in place for more than a week, and there's been some difficulties with access to food and other supplies. How are things going there at the moment?
Things in Pota village. Well, that village is actually the village of the security guard who initially was contracted the virus. That was the initial village that went on lockdown. The problem was, I think they needed to really the lockdown was not really smooth in terms of getting access to supplies and medical supplies as well. There was an emergency case that couldn't be helped. Fortunately, it wasn't catastrophic, the emergency case. But overall, the whole village were crying out for supplies. And I think it's the power of the people and the community coming together. There's been assistance and food supplies provided to them mostly by the communities and the church groups that have initiated that. So I think now they are in a much better position than last week.
Is the village still under lockdown?
Well, it still is under lockdown. It has now joined the rest of South Tarawa in lockdown.
And obviously communications are very important in times of an outbreak. But I understand there were some complaints about how the information was getting out from the government. Has that improved? What's the status there now?
Well, yeah, the news broke about the positive cases that came on the flight. You know, not officially, but they sort of leaked from officials within the quarantine centres, and so there was quite an alarm or panic by the people, and it took a number of days. Actually, I think about it was 4 days before government actually made an official announcement confirming that there was positive cases, and then to add on to that, adding that there was a community transmission case. So, you know, information is really critical in times of disaster. No one can deny that. And I think the government of Kiribati can really do much better than that. You know, we're following things that are happening in the Solomon Islands, in Fiji, in Samoa, and their leaders are quite, you know, on the spot with the updates. And keeping people in informed is just the way to go. I mean, keeping people in the dark is not, you know, will create more problems. But now that the government here is starting to pick up the pieces and I think they're sorting out the mess, information is coming sort of more regularly now recently. So like I mentioned, just on Sunday, the government announced a state of disaster, and just that the how many hours later that they announced the update of 7 more cases. So, you know, they're coming through with that. I know it's not an easy task to, you know, to handle a crisis such as a COVID-19 or a pandemic. But, yeah, they're coming through with that, and people appreciate that it's coming through.
And just finally, Ramon, I understand that that the flight that carried the passengers that did test positive for COVID, that flight sort of came in just after borders were opened in Kiribati. They'd been closed for multiple months because of the pandemic. It's a real shame, just as I guess the country opens up, that this happens. Given that, do you think Kiribati is prepared to open its borders to welcome international visitors again?
Well, personally, I don't think so. personally, I think we should be ready. It's been 2 years since we closed our borders, and to prepare everything in place before, you know, an event such as this. I think, in my opinion, that has not been the case. On the ground here, people talking on the ground here are saying, you know, pointing the fingers at the government for opening up the border and bringing in this. So at the moment, while, you know, the cases are escalating, you know, some of the leaders and community leaders are telling people, hey, look, let's not point fingers, but let's just, you know, unite and try and fight this, and let's deal with who did this and who did that after we have control of this community outbreak. So that's currently the case. People are really not happy with the flight coming in. And the general feeling is that they're not happy, that we're not ready yet to you know, to open our borders. And unfortunately, that has not been the case.
Yes, that's a real shame. Ramon, thank you so much for speaking with us this morning.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
You too. That was eKiribati journalist Ramon speaking to me from Tarawa.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Homes, villages and livelihoods have been left devastated by the volcanic eruption and tsunami in Tonga. People are now picking up the pieces as the daunting cleanup effort gets underway. For some local businesses, the financial toll will be in the millions, but the full economic impact of the disaster remains unknown. So, what will it take to rebuild? Marion Farr takes a look.
On the western coast of Tonga's main island, a resort is in ruins.
It's like a bomb hit this place, you know. It's like a war zone.
The once pristine beach is covered in ash. Trees are strewn across the ground, and the resort's buildings have been flattened.
Everything, like it's a write-off. Like it's there's nothing there.
Marian Tukuafu is the co-owner of Vakaloa Beach Resort. Up until last week, the business was thriving.
Our venue was one of the biggest here in Tonga.
But now her livelihood has literally been washed away. A tsunami triggered by the Hungatonga Hungaha'apai volcanic eruption wiped out the popular beachfront resort.
The truth is, the damage is just phenomenal. Like, we've never seen anything like that.
Ms. Tukuafu estimates the cost to rebuild will be about 3 million Tongan pa'anga, which is about 2 million Australian dollars. But it's not just her own family she's worried about. The resort and others in the area provide much-needed employment for locals.
Yeah, it's very sad. And along our coast, all the businesses are wiped out.
More than a week since the eruption, the full economic impact is still unknown. Images on social media show houses covered in ash, businesses damaged, and farming land devastated. The World Bank is working with local authorities to assess the financial impact. But Jonathan Pryke from the Lowy Institute says it's clear the cost will be substantial.
By comparison, cyclones in the region have been known to shave off, you know, up to 5% of a country's GDP if they're really badly struck. So, you know, Tonga and other Pacific nations are incredibly exposed to the economic shock of natural disasters. And, yeah, this is in a similar sort of category.
And Tonga's economy has already taken a hit with COVID-19.
They've been incredibly successful in keeping COVID out of the country and remaining one of the very few countries in the world that is COVID-free. But that's come at a huge cost to the economy. You know, it's killed tourism overnight and killed many other parts of the economy that are dependent on free movement of people in and out of the country.
Moving forward, Tonga will need help from international partners. The World Bank has provided $8 million in emergency relief, and Australia has committed an initial $1 million with expectations of more funding to come. But Mr. Pryke says another big contributor will be remittances from overseas.
Remittances to Tonga are greater per year than the Australian aid inflows to Tonga. So it's a significant component of foreign exchange, of the economy, and of just people's livelihoods and well-being.
There's already been an outpouring of financial support from Tongans around the world. But while families are eager to send money back home, accessing those funds is a challenge for people on the ground. A large undersea cable providing internet to Tonga was seriously damaged in the disaster, cutting off connectivity. While some services, including banking, are starting to come back online, it's likely to be weeks until the cable is repaired.
I'm sure it has led to a lag of these funds coming to the country.
While some businesses have been completely wiped out, others have jumped into action. Kennedy Penitani owns a bakery in Tonga's capital, Nuku'alofa. On the Sunday after the eruption, he received a call from a government minister asking him to fire up the ovens and provide food for locals.
Sunday morning, I came downstairs and then I start the generator and the boys rock up and then we start baking.
Under Tongan law, shops are usually required to close on Sunday. But Mr. Penitani says this was a special exception.
So to me, I was glad. I was glad that I do my duty to feed the people and help out at this time of hardship.
Since then, the bakery has continued operating. But Mr. Penitani says getting ingredients could be a challenge.
If the shipment doesn't come in, it would be shortage of flour, and also other ingredients for making the bread.
But he's remaining positive about the future. And so is Marian Tugwafu.
I just said, you know, this is not the end of it. I know that there's something better, but we just pray that, you know, sooner or later, you know, we'll see what we're going to be doing. We've still got the heart to go on. like they say, you know, we're Mate Ma Tonga, you know, we die for Tonga. So that's the heart that we have, really.
That was Marian Tukuafu, ending that report by Marian Farr. Now let's find out what's making news all around the region. And to do that, I'm joined by Richard Hewitt. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Priyanka.
Now, first, let's head to Fiji, where the COVID situation there is getting a bit interesting. The borders may be open and tourists are certainly flocking into the country, but restrictions are still remaining in force.
Yeah, it's a bit of a balancing act, I think, they're attempting to pull off in Fiji at the moment. I think the figure I've seen is 70,000 tourists expected to have gone through the country by the end of January, and I think it was 30,000 in December. But against that background, the advice that's coming from the Fijian health authorities to the government, and particularly through the Permanent Health Secretary, Dr. James Fong, is that they are concerned about the risk of a resurgence in COVID-19 infections. 16 deaths reported over the weekend, almost 350 new cases of community infection, with Dr. Fong suggesting the spike was down to the relaxation of some health measures in November. And this seems to apply more to the local community, the necessarily the incoming tourists, although you would think the two were kind of inextricably linked. Mm-hmm. Dr. Fong has told the Fijian media his biggest concern is the oversight of COVID-safe measures in the informal settlements. And I mean, that's a problem not just in Fiji, but elsewhere in the Pacific, particularly in PNG, of course. Dr. Fong has found a supporter in the form of Sean Casey. He's the World Health Organization's Pacific Health Cluster Coordinator. He says proactive and strict measures need to be taken to avoid COVID-19 emergencies. And we were talking earlier in the program about the situation in Samoa, Solomon Islands, Kiribati, Palau.
Yes,
so,
indeed.
So it goes on. Yes. Mr. Casey says countries like Fiji cannot afford to let their guard down. I guess that's the key, as the spread of the Omicron and Delta variants remain rampant. And he says in the community, individual measures are the best way to avoid severe impact. So it's still, you know, getting that message across to people, individuals, you and I, whoever, to do the right thing, wash your hands, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, we're definitely in the midst of it here in Melbourne, and I know it's important, even though things are opening up, to still socially distance, wear masks, where we're doing that in the office, in the studios right now, and take all those important measures. So, yes, good good, important reminder for people in Fiji as well.
I think so. And I think, Dr. Fong has, he's got a pretty tight lid on the whole thing so far as best he can as the man at the sharp end. And so he continues.
And now let's head to Vanuatu. Now, I understand the threat of a teacher's strike still not gone away. The union leaders are now saying it'll go ahead unless the government intervenes. What do they want?
Well, this is curious. There's a bit of shadow boxing that's been going on between the teachers and the government in Vanuatu for quite some time now. Now, I mean, what they want is improved pay and conditions. Mm. But as things stand, the strike is scheduled for February the 7th. And George Fideon, the industrial officer for the teachers' union, he told the Vanuatu Daily Post there has been no intervention yet from the Internal Affairs Ministry, which apparently is the only authority with the power to prevent the teachers from taking action. But in the meantime, Mr. Fideon says all teachers are required to turn up to their respective schools and prepare themselves for the new academic year. So they're going about it in a fairly diplomatic way, it would seem. From the government's point of view, the Commissioner of Labour, Muriel Meltonovan, has confirmed that her office has conducted an assessment and asked the Internal Affairs Minister to discontinue the strike. She explained that the service provided by the teachers is considered an essential service, therefore they won't allow the strike to continue. She says the academic year is about to commence and teachers are expected to be in their schools and carry out their duties. She's further confirmed that the state law office is expected to work on finalising an appropriate document and the union should be receiving a letter of discontinuity by next week. So teachers are saying the strike is on because no one's told us to call it off. Those that can call it off say they're going to call it off. They just haven't got around to sending out the letter yet. I think that's a fair summary.
That's a confusing state of affairs, though, for students and parents looking to start.
That's the thing, isn't it? There's this area of doubt still. I mean, how long does it take to write a letter saying you can't go on strike? I don't know.
Indeed, yes, something to look ahead at. Now to sport, and a golden invitation for ambitious young rugby players has been made in Fiji. What's going on?
Yeah, the Fiji Rugby Union, they're throwing the door open for players in the under-20 age group who think these are male players, I should point out at this stage. I've no doubt they will do the same thing for the women at
Let's
the appropriate
hope so.
Time. Oh, absolutely, they're working both ways over there for sure, very hard, and both sides are doing very well. But this is the men's under-20 group, and the idea is that if you think you're good enough to represent your country, if you're Fijian and you want to play at the Oceania Under-20 tournament, which is scheduled to take place on the Sunshine Coast here in Australia in July, well, now is your opportunity. Players in Fiji, and indeed those living overseas but who are qualified to play for Fiji, have been invited to submit expressions of interest to the head coach, Ifuremi Rawanga. Once the list is closed, the players in the mix will be put through fitness testing, there'll be screening, and then they'll be sorted into trial teams, from which the final squad will be selected. Overseas-based players who want to be part of the trials, they'll be given a cut-off date by when they would be expected to be in the country. And as we can imagine, that might not be the easiest trip for them to make. And presumably they would have to complete any necessary COVID-19 protocols, quarantine demands and all that sort of thing. So if they are thinking of coming from overseas, they need to get moving, really. Very important, any player wanting to be involved from Fiji or overseas clearly has to be vaccinated. That is the rule in Fiji at the moment. You can't play sport if you're not vaccinated. Mm-hmm. So an unusual way, I think, to select a rugby squad. I'm not sure I've come across it being done in this way before, but perhaps a reflection of the time. And if you are a player who believes you have what it takes to play for the Fijian under-20s, then the closing date for expressions of interest, just 4 days away, January the 29th. So get your emails in to the FRU, and who knows, you could be in the mix and playing on the Sunshine Coast for Fiji come July.
Yes,
fingers crossed.
Yes, exciting. What a great opportunity.
Well, yeah, you know, new stars could be born literally through an email.
Yeah, yes, that's right. Yeah, exciting times. Thank you, Richard, for those headlines.
No problem.
That was Richard Hewitt with what was making news around the region.
Natural disasters can take many forms. A flood, cyclone, tsunami, fire, or earthquake can mean you need to leave your home quickly. If a disaster strikes your home, you need to be prepared. If you live somewhere that is prone to natural disasters, a bag filled with essential items could save your life. This bag is called a go bag. Inside your go bag, you should have the things you need to survive. Water, food, medicine, copies of precious documents, a whistle to alert emergency services, toiletries including menstrual hygiene packs, a radio, first aid kit, blankets and protective clothing, hand sanitizer, light, tools like knives and can openers, garbage bags. If you make a gold bag, tell your friends and family. Disasters may be inevitable, but the loss of your life or your family are not.
Now, a trial of commercial carver imports into Australia is about to begin after an anxious delay for many producers. At least two companies were granted permits to start the process, but hundreds of carver growers in Fiji are still waiting to get their foot in the door. Other importers and exporters are struggling to meet Australian requirements. And as Mackenzie Smith reports, there's concern that unless regulations are improved, the new market could worsen the ongoing problem of deforestation in the Pacific.
Since Australia's long-awaited reopening of commercial carver imports in December, there's been a flood of interest from prospective importers and exporters. It's hoped the supplies will help lower carver prices for Australia's Pacific community, which struggled when the drink was only able to be brought in small quantities for personal use. But for many carver farmers in the Pacific, that's easier said than done. Alifereti Tawaki helps run the Kandavu Carver Farmers Association in Fiji, which has around 300 members. He says they're keen to get on board with exporting to Australia, but only for the right price.
If the demand from Australia comes with the return that they need, then it'll be, that's a big help for them. Right now, I heard what they are advising each other, the farmers in Kandavu at least, is hold on to your grog, hold on to your cover plants until the prices are right.
Mr. Tawaki says local kava farmers haven't seen much progress with profits from export markets, where they have little negotiation power. Right now, he says export sales are also roughly the same as local prices, leaving little incentive for them to make the switch. That hasn't stopped Fiji's Green Gold Carver, which was able to send 700 kilograms of its products to Australia this month, according to Australia's ambassador to Fiji, John Feeks. And after becoming one of the first to secure an import permit, another company, Fiji Carver, says its products are expected to hit Australian supermarket shelves this month. Where larger companies are making headway, though, Alifereti Tawaki says smaller exporters are struggling to meet export requirements.
There are some biosecurity requirements that have to be met. A packing shed instead to be able to meet some of the standards and requirements before we apply for the export permit from this site. And then after then, we have to find somebody with an import business with an import permit from Australian side.
And he says getting the details right is crucial for the farmers.
It's very, very important for the farmers. They're able to pay for their kids to school, able to improve their livelihoods, even build their houses. So the industry is quite critical for most of the cover farming communities, which are probably nationwide in Fiji.
Richard Markham is a cocoa grower in Fiji and adjunct professor in sustainable development at the University of the Sunshine Coast. He's worried a cover boom could worsen environmental concerns in an already troubled industry.
It's only when it becomes commercial that the cascade of environmental effects tends to take off and the price goes up, then people are looking for bigger tracts of land, and that's when they're going out and clearing rainforests in search of fertile soil. You know, the carver needs fertile soil, and the easiest way to arrange for that is to burn some forests, which releases the nutrients, and you get a decent crop of carver.
Those concerns are also being raised in Vanuatu, where the opposition leader Ralph Reganvanu says new carver plantations are the leading cause of deforestation. Dr. Markham says Australia has a responsibility to help farmers in the Pacific adopt more sustainable farming practices.
It would probably still be unwise to plant carver and then carver again and then carver again, but there's no reason why you shouldn't grow carver and then grow a kind of rotation of beans or with some ginger or something like that, and then rotate back to cover rather than just abandoning the land and waiting for bush fallow to restore it.
Australia's cover imports trial will run until the end of 2023, when the government will decide whether to legislate the policy.
That was Mackenzie Smith reporting. There are few things in the natural world as joyful as a butterfly. Dr. Trevor Lambkin is an entomologist and butterfly collector. Richard Fidler has been speaking to Dr. Lambkin, who has been pursuing butterflies in the islands of the Torres Strait almost all his adult life. He's built a collection of more than 12,000 specimens.
If you've had any experience with butterflies, if you try to handle them, you end up with the colour all over your fingers. Mm. So what, microscopically, they are, the butterfly wing is like a see-through, I'll call it a sheer plastic panel with veins, but overlaid over that sheer panel are a multitude, tens of thousands of what we call them in the scientific world scales, but they're like roof shingles, and they all fit on top of each other, and they all stack in rows, and it depends on how they're stacked and how reflective they are and their colour that will basically determine what colour the wings are.
How does mating work between butterflies? Do they mount one another or what?
Many of the species, actually, they do what is like a courtship. I'll call it a dance, I suppose. It's like where generally the female is sitting still and the male's fluttering around it, and then it comes down and mates. And then quite often the male then will fly with the female joined. Many species do that. And you very rarely see this. For example, I was in the Torres Strait last year, and there was this beautiful butterflies called leafwing butterflies. They just look like a leaf underneath their wings. And then you very rarely see the male and female in this courtship dance. But this was very late in the afternoon, and it was almost dusk. And here they were just in this general flutter. The female was sitting there and the male's fluttering around. And, it's always done either at a time or a place that's very much set aside, and there's very few predators around when they do it. So, yeah.
Tell me about your first trip then up to the Torres Strait in the early 1980s.
I worked for what was then called the Department of Primary Industries based in Brisbane. I was based at Indooroopilly. And we had a visiting quarantine officer that was getting stationed up on Thursday Island, and I just got talking to him about TI and thought it was an interesting area, and talked to him about butterflies up there, because I knew that you did get some interesting things up in the Torres Strait. And I started talking to him, and he said, look, if you're thinking of coming up there, you know, look me up and I'll find some accommodation for you. So I took him up on the deal, and I asked my good friend Ian Knight at the time, and I said, was he interested in coming up? And he said, yeah, I'll be in it. So in 1983, we went up and stayed about 10 days, and we visited. We were based on Thursday Island. We went across to Horn Island, went across to Hammond Island, and we went across to Prince of Wales Island. So we did some survey work across those three or four islands.
When you go out to one of those islands in the Torres Strait, I haven't been there. I think the furthest north I've been in Australia is Cooktown, so I've never been to the Torres Strait. I'd love to go there one day. What's it like on those islands once you head out there, going into the wilderness looking for butterflies?
There's 17 inhabited islands in the Strait, and their geology or physiography varies. Some are terrestrial islands, what we call terrestrial, like bits of Queensland. Others are boulder-like, like bits of New Guinea. Others are volcanic, like, say, the area around Port Moresby. And there are several coral cay islands in the middle, and then a couple of mud islands in the top. So they all vary in their plant diversity, their butterfly diversity, their geology. And it's just a matter of just going around basically looking, and of course where you look is based on your knowledge of what types of environments you're looking at. So A lot of collecting is done along the road, where is a, it's normally a good area for butterflies, along roads where there's flowers, along edges of forest. And quite often you've got to go into tracks in the forest as well for those species that, that fly along tracks. So you've got to look at all sorts of different environments.
Is it green and noisy there most of the time?
Green and noisy.
Yeah, with nature. Yeah.
Well, this time of year, actually, in January, it's very noisy with cicadas. There are plenty of cicadas on those islands, so it's quite noisy in that way. But and this time of year, of course, the wet season's started up there, and everything just becomes green and lush and jungle-like. And this time of year, the islands are quite attractive looking.
How do you catch them? Is it with a net, like we imagine people do, going around like a Lepidopterus? Is that you?
That's exactly how you collect them, unless you know what host plant they're on, they feed on. Then you can look for immature stages and then rear them through. But the bulk, because you're only up there for a limited time, the bulk of the material you do collect are the adults. And you use a butterfly net, yes, yeah.
And once you've caught them, what do you do with them?
There's a couple of different ways that you can treat them once you collect them. You get them in the net, and of course there's a couple of different ways. Some butterfly collectors actually just give the specimen just a sharp little pinch on the thorax, and that stuns them, and then they put them into like glassine packets and store them in a box in their rucksack. Other people like myself, we use what's called a stunning jar. It's a jar with a chemical in the bottom that stuns them. We put them in there, they get stunned, and then we bring them back to the room. Once you get them back to your quarters, then you put them in a relaxing box. The box has got where they, they just chill out in there. You know, they're basically not alive anymore. You have to actually kill them, because like any animal, rigor mortis sets in within 12 hours, and then you have to wait for rigor mortis to stop. Once that stops, then I take up some setting boards, etc., and I know other collectors do as well, and they actually set them on site, the smaller ones. And then the larger ones we put into glassine envelopes and put them into airtight sort of Tupperware containers and keep them frozen. We can bring them back frozen, put them in the freezer back home, and then we can bring them out at leisure and prepare them and set them.
Poor butterflies. That was entomologist Dr. Trevor Lamkin speaking to Richard Feidler. And that was part of a story on the ABC's Conversations podcast. You can hear more of Trevor's butterfly adventures by searching Conversations wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app. But that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. I'll be back the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 3 p.m. PNG time with Talia Olatia. Thanks so much for sticking around. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. Look and mew tomorrow.